The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Smithsonian. How about that? Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. We're reading today from the combined July-August edition of Smithsonian, The Moment of Truth. And there's a very old General Electric clock sitting on a bench. An exclusive visit to the secret U.S. laboratory where scientists developed the first nuclear weapon. We thought of the legend of Prometheus, of that deep sense of guilt in man's new powers that reflect his recognition of evil and his long knowledge of it, by J. Robert Oppenheimer. In February 1943, the Los Alamos Ranch School, an outdoorsy institution for boys, abruptly closed its doors so the U.S. government could take over the campus. A local poet named Peggy Pond Church, daughter of the school's founder, later described the element of extreme haste and mystery that surrounded the whole operation. As bulldozers arrived on the New Mexico campus, she had her first glimpse of J. Robert Oppenheimer. "Cowboy boots and all," she wrote. He hurried into the front door and out the back, peering quickly into the kitchen and bedrooms. I was impressed, even in that brief meeting, by his nervous energy and by the intensity of the blue eyes that seemed to take in everything at a glance, like a bird flying from branch to branch in a deep forest. Oppenheimer, then 38, had been tapped to lead a facility that government documents called Project Y. The letter Y, that is. The physicists working there were part of the ultra-secret Manhattan Project, and they had one goal, developing the first nuclear weapon before the Nazis beat them to it. The effort needed a remote location, but Oppenheimer was especially partial to the ranch school site. A native of New York City, he hadn't always strutted around in cowboy boots, but he'd fallen in love with the wilderness near Santa Fe during his teens and twenties. Later, he and his family bought a cabin in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. They called it Piro Caliente, reportedly because Oppenheimer shouted, "Hot dog," when he found out the cabin was available. Los Alamos had views of the same mountain range. During the last 2 years of World War II, between 1,500 and 8,200 scientists and staff members lived on the ranch school campus and in a quickly constructed nearby town. One of the first to arrive in March 1943 was Richard Feynman, F-E-Y-N-M-A-N, another New Yorker who had recently earned his Ph.D. at Princeton University. The beauty of the scenery for a person from the East who didn't travel much was sensational, Feynman later said. There are the great cliffs that you've probably seen in pictures. You'd come up from below and be very surprised to see this high mesa. The nearby houses were still under construction. We were all jammed in there in bunk beds, Feynman recalled. Another theoretical physicist and his wife had to pass through Feynman's bedroom to get to the bathroom. The town of Los Alamos was soon up and running, but its existence remained secret. All its residents shared the same mailing address, P.O. Box 1663. Many people on the support staff were young military personnel and sequestered away from the world. They had to create their own entertainment. Square dancing evolved as a natural Saturday evening activity in that southwestern setting. Richard Rhodes wrote in his definitive history the making of the atom bomb, single men and women sponsored dorm parties fueled with tanks of punch made potent with mixed liquors. The married scientists found their own ways to relax. The Oppenheimers rode horses on Sunday mornings. Enrico Fermi, who'd recently built the world's first nuclear reactor, he liked to climb mountains with his colleague, Hans Bethe, B-E-T-H-E, where they could look out at the world from 12,500 feet. They'd fled their homelands because of anti-Semitism. Fermi's wife was Jewish. Bethe had Jewish ancestry. The scientists' minds were crammed with physics problems and moral questions. "I had many sleepless nights," recalled the British physicist James Chadwick in a 1969 interview, and I had then to start taking sleeping pills. It was the only remedy. On July 16, 1945, the breakthroughs at Los Alamos were put to the rest in a world-changing experiment called Trinity, a few hours south in the New Mexico desert. At 5:29 a.m., onlookers saw a blinding flash of light. "It blasted, it pounced, it bored its way right through you," wrote Nobel Prize-winning physicist Isidore Isaac Rabin, who was there that day. "It was a vision which was seen with more than the eye. It was seen to last forever. You would wish it would stop. Altogether, it lasted about 2 seconds. The flash gave way to a massive fireball with streaks of yellow, red, and green. It looked menacing. It seemed to come toward one. A new thing had just been born, a new control, a new understanding of man, which man had acquired over nature." A few weeks later, on August 6, Americans dropped the first atom bomb, devastating the Japanese city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, another plane dropped an atom bomb on Nagasaki on the evening of August 14. President Harry S. Truman told reporters at the White House that Japan had surrendered. That was the last time nuclear weapons were used in combat, though their proliferation still causes countless cases of insomnia. The scientists who developed the weapons live on in the public's imagination, most recently inspiring the Christopher Nolan film Oppenheimer, which opens this summer. Los Alamos is still an active national laboratory, and the Manhattan Project sites are still off-limits to the public. Photographer Minish Barkrania, a physicist who worked in the lab's nonproliferation division from 2006 to 2012, received special permission to take these photos for Smithsonian of restricted historic sites that are no longer in operation. "You can trace so many discoveries back to the work done at Los Alamos," Barkrania says. "The Manhattan Project and the Cold War gave rise to innovations like integrated circuits, earth-sensing satellites, new medical imaging techniques, and high-performance computing. That iPhone in your pocket can be traced all the way back to a little shed in a canyon," he notes. Still, Los Alamos will always be remembered as the birthplace of the atom bomb. Many would argue that this weapon had secured a kind of peace as superpowers continue to avoid mutually assured destruction. But the scientists themselves never stopped grappling with what they'd done. "The physicists have known sin," Oppenheimer said 2 years after the war, "and this is a knowledge which they cannot lose." On a lighter note, material wealth, and by material we mean cloth. the treasure of today's fiber artists. How wonderful to be surprised by something entirely new that is rooted in ancient tradition. Thus, the delight of seeing Bissa Butler's dazzling quilt portraits, Marque Marzin's exquisitely intertwined pieces, and Janice Arnold's vast wool felt sculptures. They represent America's renewed passion for textile art. And there's some beautiful colors here. Dreaming in Color, Bissa Butler's exuberant portraits celebrate Black history and take quilting to a new level, by Jacoba Urist. Excuse the page rattling here. We'll get settled here in a second. Bissa Butler's portrait of Harriet Tubman began with a minuscule black and white carte de visite. I'm probably hammering that. The 19th century photograph featured the famed Underground Railroad conductor when she was around 40, about the age Butler was at the time. "I blew the photo up," Butler says. "Is she looking at me?" "She is. What would she think of everything that I think I have hard in life?" By 2021, Butler's large quilted portrait, "I Go to Prepare a Place for You," was hanging in the Smithsonian's National Museum of African and American History and Culture. Made entirely out of fabric, it portrays Tubman in a kaleidoscope of colors. Her skin is a contrast of cool blues and fiery reds, capturing her need to hide along with her tenacity and courage. The background of sunflower symbolizes the constancy of the North Star as Tubman's unwavering faith. The gold, orange, and green in her skirt suggest her African heritage. A renowned portraitist, I've never seen that word, Butler has done for quilt making what Matisse did for paper cutting, elevating a humble technique to a high art. For years, quilting has been dismissed by the fine arts world as decorative craft or domestic labor. Butler's stunning work has helped shatter that barrier. She made her first portrait, Francis and Violet, grandparents, while pursuing a master's in arts education in 2001. Today, her life-size quilts hang in museums across the country. She focuses on people of African descent, but avoids representational skin tone. Her subjects shimmer in brilliant hues of fuchsia, imperial blue or acid green, with a purple lip, an orange cheekbone, or a turquoise temple for emphasis. Butler always begins with a photograph. Her sources vary widely. Farm Security Administration archives, a 1909 Rufus Holsinger portrait, Janet Beckman's fiercely feminist 1987 photo of rapper Salt-N-Pepa. The last of these was a suggestion from her husband, John Butler, a longtime professional DJ. She takes time to divine her subject's spirits, studying their gaze and stances, their clothing and accessories. "I grew up looking at my family photos, which were black and white," she says. "I was so curious about these people and places I would never know. My maternal grandmother would talk to me about her Louisiana Creole relatives. My father spoke to me about the liberation of Ghana, his birthplace, in 1954, and I wish I had been there." Butler enlarges each image on photo paper using a Sharpie to delineate light to dark gradation. "I use that like a dressmaker's pattern," she says. "I cut shapes based off my sketch and layer them until I have an image that is an impression of the original." Over the decades, she has collected snippets and swaths of material, which she stores in large plastic bins. Silk, wool, lace, velvet, hand-dyed batiks, vibrant African Dutch waxes, holographic vinyl. I feel my mother and grandmother's presence because some of the fabrics I use are still some of the fabrics, some of their fabrics, she tells me in her Jersey City studio. When you open the bin, the scent of jasmine and rose comes out. My mother was Muslim and wore Muslim oils. I don't know how many years it takes or how long that oil is going to smell like her. The selection, cutting, pinning, and layering process consumes hundreds of hours. After all of that, I load my quilt top onto my quilting machine and stitch it together with the batting and backing fabric, she says, describing a sewing practice known as appliqué. Until last August, Butler worked from her home in South Orange, New Jersey, annexing the dining room table and living room floor, stitching by hand or on a standard household sewing machine. Today, in her studio, she uses two giant long-arm quilting machines, affectionately named Godzilla and Godzuki, after the 1970s Hanna-Barbera children's series. This is my first professional space, Butler says. She gets a lot of portrait requests, but she only takes the one she finds personally meaningful. Last year, the New York Times asked her to make a quilt of the late African-American science fiction writer Octavia Butler. I used to go to the Library of Congress when I was in school in 1994, to read her unpublished manuscripts at those tables with the little green light, the artist says. She took the assignment. Looking at the finished quilt in person, you can see the writer's silver hair glinting with rhinestones and sparkle vinyl. Butler, the artist, wanted to capture the celestial realm occupied by Butler, the science fiction writer. An intellect that is always thinking beyond. There's a shape on the collar that looks like a UFO. But Butler says it's a piece of Nana Ben's fabric from Togo. It was made to celebrate African women who felt that children were the greatest blessing, she says. In a 2017 portrait called The Tea, as in to spill the tea or gossip, Butler started with a Depression-era photograph by Russell Lee of three women from Chicago's South Side standing together on Easter morning. I like to play with skin color and its emotion, Butler says. Red, pink, and yellow represent passion and love. They can even signify anger. It depends on their intensity. The woman in the tea, have cool-hued complexions reflecting their dignity and refinement. When you look at her quilts, you know from the facial features that the subject matter is African-American, says Yale University Art Gallery curator Michelle Wiege, W-I-J-E, who co-organized the 2020 to 2021 exhibit Bisa Butler Portraits at the Katana Museum of Art and the Art Institute of Chicago. But Bisa allows the viewer to step away from that idea because she uses all of these vivid colors that express emotions. Wiege likens Butler to German Expressionists, the early 20th century artists who strategically employed unnatural flesh tones in their paintings. You are put in a different relationship with the person. When Butler was earning her bachelor's in fine arts at Howard University in the early 1990s, the dean of her department was Jeff Donaldson, one of five co-founders of the Black Artist Collection, Afro-Bra, the African commune of bad relevant artists, in parentheses. The Chicago-based art movement coined the term Kool-Aid colors, a descriptor Butler embraces. If you didn't have money, you could paint with Kool-Aid, Butler says. It was about self-expression as a black artist, creating your own color palette outside of the European painting tradition. In her free time, she made African print mini dresses, but didn't yet realize she could combine her passion with her major. During her pregnancy, in her last semester at Howard, she found it increasingly difficult to paint because the smell made her nauseated. "I had my first daughter and thought I would never paint again," Butler says. "She was an active toddler, and I needed to keep all toxic materials away from her." After Butler earned her master's from Montclair State University, she taught art full-time until 2018. Her job involved building student self-esteem. "Teenagers are so sensitive," she says. "If their neighbor next to them draws really well and they don't, they shut down. I don't want to do it. It's stupid anyway." She wanted her students to feel good about themselves. The emotional atmosphere in the classroom is just as important as what you're teaching. No matter how spent she was at each evening, she'd come home and devote at least half an hour to quilting, like a painter wielding a brush and mixing glazes. Butler creates light and shadow, contours and shading, but she does this entirely through the textures, patterns, and placements of her fibers. "There is zero paint on this artwork," Butler frequently reminds viewers when she posts her work on social media. "The history of quilt making demonstrates the rich diversity of American culture," says Erica Warren, an art historian who co-organized the 2020 to 2021 Chicago exhibition with Ouija. "In the 21st century, quilters from the remote hamlet of Gee's Bend, Alabama, a black artist community with roots going back to the 1800s, finally received their due with exhibitions at the Whitney Museum of American Art and pieces at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. The Metropolitan Museum of Art and the New Museum displayed Faith Ringgold's story quilts, which use fabric and, unlike Butler's works, paint to depict the life, identity, and history of black people. In many ways, Kendall Wiley, painter of the famed portrait of former President Barack Obama at the National Portrait Gallery, is part of this renaissance. His portraits riff on old European masters, but he renders black subjects against flamboyant floral backgrounds. Yet, even by these standards, Butler is pushing the limits. Bisa is using all of these coded symbols to imagine her subjects, embodying who they were, says Warren. This takes portraiture to another emotional or surreal level. Her largest quilt to date, completed in 2022 and measuring 9 by 13 feet, is titled "Don't Tread on Me, Let's Go, The Harlem Hellfighters." Now part of the Smithsonian American Art Museum's permanent collection, it took nearly a year to complete. "I chose the photo just from perusing the National Archives," says Butler. "I thought, oh wow, look at these guys. They look so great. Who are the Hellfighters? How is the name so bad and I've never heard it before in my life?" The men in the 1919 photo were members of the 369th Infantry Regiment. The unit earned its nickname after showing valor alongside French soldiers in the trenches. Butler's resplendent portrait includes a fabric with lions that appears in African marketplaces under the name "I Am the Guard by the Gates." That represents these men as the guardians of democracy, Butler says. Another fabric in the portrait features letters and hearts. The nickname for that fabric is "Love Letter," says Butler. I thought about movies I've seen and how many young men died with a letter in their pocket to their mother or their sister. The week after my studio visit, I drove to Pleasantville, New York, to see Mater Familias, Butler's gallery exhibition at the Gordon Parks Foundation, the culmination of her 2022 Gordon Parks Artist Fellowship. Then I got to see a shimmery new brocade portrait based on a photograph by Gordon Parks himself. In 1956, Life magazine sent the pioneering black photographer to Mobile, Alabama, to cover black Americans living under Jim Crow laws. One of his iconic photographs, Department Store, featured an aunt and niece standing sidewalk under a neon sign that said, Colored Entrance. In the original, both subjects wore pale, elegant lace dresses, a fallen slip strap famously gazing the woman's shoulder in Butler's version. The little girl, Shirley Kirksey, later Blackwell, is dressed in whimsical fabrics with swirls evoking giant lollipops. Most of the fabrics for the little girl were chosen to symbolize things that my own little girls love, candy and toys, says Butler. To dress the aunt, Joanne Wilson, Butler built a skirt out of a cloth named Michelle Obama's bag, made after the First Lady's 2009 visit to Africa and the handbag she carried on the tarmac. While she may have lived in the Jim Crow South, there's a future beyond, Butler says of the woman in the picture. There will one day be an African-American First Lady. Around her waist, Wilson wears a popular African pattern called OPA, O-P-O-B-A-A-P-A, or Good Woman, which symbolizes her care for her young niece. The fabric of her purple blouse was designed by City of Joy, a refuge in the eastern region of the Democratic Republic of Congo for women recovering from war-related violence. Its subtly abstracted flower petals commemorate the refugee's physical healing. The colored entrance sign above the top of the artwork is printed with plants and covered with dark red stitching. I chose the green fabric with white flower buds because it reminded me of the way I've seen cotton look on a vine. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed today's reading. I'm Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.